Well, some of us are still recovering from a surfeit of birthday cake. Welcome to the fifth of this series of Darwin College lectures on the theme of Darwin. The last couple of lectures, we've looked at the impact of his thought on thinking in science and in literature. And tonight we turn to his impact on thinking about human society. And our speaker is a very eclectic economist. They do exist, you know. Paul Seabright, who's professor of economics at Toulouse University. Paul did his first, second, and third degrees at Oxford and became a prize fellow of All Souls College. He then had the good sense to come to teach in the economics faculty here in Cambridge, where he was a fellow of Churchill College. Paul is a leading expert on the imperfections of competition, having studied wacky markets in broadcasting and airlines and countries emerging from communism and so on. But apart from that high-tech economics, he's also distinctive in being an exceptionally good communicator about economic things to normal people. He's written a lot for the London Review of Books, for Financial Times, and currently he's writing a lot for Le Monde. The particular aspect of Paul Seabright's work that made us keen to have him, though, was that 4 or so years ago he produced a book called The Company of Strangers, A Natural History of Economic Life, which addressed a very Darwinian paradox that Homo sapiens is a species which engages in complex tasks with others of the same species to whom they are genetically unrelated. It's a pleasure to introduce Paul Seabright to talk about Darwin and human society.
Thank you very much for that very generous introduction. It's with great trepidation that I approach this task. I don't think I've ever spoken before an audience that contains so many people who know so much more than I do about almost every topic on which I'm going to touch during the course of the lecture. It's also a topic on which many greater scholars than I have said things they either regretted or should have regretted. So to say that I am approaching this with trepidation is what my colleagues in Toulouse would call the English understatement. Many myths have been created about Darwin. This is a cartoon from the New Yorker, and as you can see, it describes 700,000 years of progress, which is wrong by at least an order of magnitude. Charles Darwin, whose birthday we celebrated yesterday, has been associated in the mind of the educated public with a notion of competition as fierce, unforgiving, and absolutely omnipresent. That vision is one that has haunted the late 19th century and the 20th century, and it has given rise to images in the arts and in the writing of history and the study of human societies, which view competition as almost a disease, as something about the mass in human society that pits us, each of us, against all the others. These lines from T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland have been repeated many times. A crowd flowed over London Bridge, so many, I had not thought death had undone so many. If you write those words into Google and you look at the images that crop up, you will find that The Wasteland has been used to stimulate the photographic imagination of people all over the world. I'm going to start by showing you some photographs of London Bridge. Here's an early photograph of the crowd flowing over London Bridge in around 1904. Here is a photograph taken in 2007 by Peter Adams, showing alienated, anxious individuals on their way to work. But it's not just in London that you find those images. As I say, if you look on Google, you don't have to look very far to find images of competition in the crowd, of alienation, of separation from your fellow human beings, from places as far apart as Osaka, where this picture shows people crossing a pedestrian crossing on their way to work with, we are given to imagine, some kind of rendezvous with an arena of stress and competition against their fellow human beings. All the way to St. Petersburg, where this extraordinary series of photographs by Alexei Titarenko shows the individual lost in the mass, streaming who knows where, but to a rendezvous with a dangerous and threatening destiny. If we can escape being intoxicated by the poetry and stop for a moment and look at the world around us as we actually meet it day by day, almost everything about this picture of competition as it infuses our day-to-day life is inaccurate. Think what happens when you leave your house in the morning. You may live alone, but if you don't live alone, you will be leaving a household full of people with whom you need to cooperate. You may take public transport to work. The bus driver is somebody on whose competent fulfilling of their function you absolutely depend. This is not a competitor, this is a collaborator. You may buy your newspaper from somebody who has thoughtfully made it available for you. This is a collaborator, not a competitor. You then arrive at your place of work, and economists would recognize that the test of whether somebody is a competitor is, by and large, whether you're pleased when they do a good job. How many of you get into your office and are pleased to discover that the other people in the office have done a bad job? So competition is everywhere, and the picture that I just painted to you, that is allegedly the one that Charles Darwin left to us, of competition everywhere, fierce, unforgiving, omnipresent, makes no sense of the ties of collaboration that we have with all of the people that we meet on our day-to-day route to work and from work. This picture, also of a crowd flowing over London Bridge, might strike you, if you looked at it uncritically, as being the same faceless mass of individuals, all alienated, separated from each other. But if you look a little more closely, it's actually a group of strikers crossing London Bridge. This is from the London dock strike of 1911, united on some kind of common purpose. And the reason I'm showing you this picture is just to show that actually pictures can be read many ways, that if we have uncritically absorbed the picture of competition as everywhere, we may look at pictures like this, or the pictures that I've shown you from St. Petersburg or Osaka or London, and think we see omnipresent, ferocious competition everywhere, when in fact the truth is different. And the story I'm going to tell you today is about how the difference of that truth was evident even to Charles Darwin, according to whom allegedly we owe the picture of omnipresent and ferocious competition. But let me start with a puzzle. Suppose everything I've said is true. Supposing that collaboration is everywhere, cooperation is everywhere. Suppose that on our day-to-day ride into work, we meet far more of our collaborators, our cooperators, than our competitors. Why does it all feel so stressful? Now, questions like that about the role of stress in social life are not questions that my discipline is very equipped to answer. Economists don't like to think about stress. I'm going to tell you some of the things that we do like to think about, but these are questions I think that would not surprise a primatologist. Primatologists know, and I'm sure there are primatologists in the audience who will be watching what I say with a very critical eye. One of the things about primatologists is that they're a primate group too. Primatologists know that human societies are highly structured, that they involve competition between groups and cooperation within groups, and that process can be very stressful. I'm going to return to the subject of stress in a moment. Let me first of all set out what I want to achieve during the course of the talk this evening. The first thing I want to do is just to describe competition and cooperation as Darwin saw them. I'm going to read to you a short passage from The Descent of Man, which is the great book in which he talked about human society and the way it functioned. And I'm going to emphasize that Darwin himself never thought of competition as fierce and omnipresent in the way that has often been ascribed to him. And in fact, Darwin was very aware of our situation as a species of primate, and I want to talk a little bit about what that means. I want to talk about the respects in which we are very obviously and recognizably a primate society. But then I want to talk about what makes us different from other primates. And in fact, we're different from other primates in a lot of ways. Some of them are very obvious, and I'm not going to belabor those points of difference. What I am going to talk about is some of the slightly less obvious ways in which we are very special primates indeed. And then I want to spend about half of the talk on the theory of sexual selection, which was central to Darwin's book, The Descent of Man. And I want to describe why sexual selection came to play such an important role in explaining the way human societies behave. And then I'm going to venture, if that weren't controversial enough, I'm going to venture onto the very vexed issue of what Darwin really thought about gender and race. And if I get out of this room alive, that will be, I think, the part of the talk where our picture of Darwin comes to be the most complex and, in my view, interesting. But I'd like to suggest to you that Darwin's own views on competition are ones that we need to understand as much more sophisticated and nuanced than the ones that most of us think of when the word Darwinism is uttered in our hearing. Okay, so I promised you a short reading from Darwin. It's a paragraph from The Descent of Man, and I haven't cherry-picked it. This is a paragraph that I think fairly reflects the way in which Darwin thought that human societies worked. When two tribes of primeval man living in the same country came into competition, he wrote, if other circumstances being equal, the one tribe included a great number of courageous, sympathetic, and faithful members who were always ready to warn each other of danger, to aid and defend each other, this tribe would succeed better and conquer the other. Selfish and contentious people will not cohere, and without coherence, nothing can be effected. A tribe rich in the above qualities would spread and be victorious over other tribes. Thus, the social and moral qualities would tend slowly to advance and be diffused throughout the world. So Darwin clearly believed not only that human beings were capable of the social and moral qualities, but he believed that there was no antithesis between them and the process of natural selection. Natural selection would indeed, he believed, encourage them. Now you'll see in a moment that this picture had a dark side, because the process by which natural selection would encourage the social and moral qualities would be by a process of competition between groups, some of whose consequences would be very bloody. And I'm going to talk about some of those consequences shortly. Let me first get out of the way some presuppositions about the role of heredity in social behavior. This is a subject which was so controversial and so full of confusion and misunderstanding during the 150 years that followed the publication of The Origin of Species that, to be honest, I had doubts about even including this slide in my talk. The purpose of doing so is simply to say what I shall be taking for granted in the rest of the argument. This is a talk about what Darwin thought about cooperation and about heredity. It's not a talk about what other people thought Darwin thought about these matters. But let me first of all say that Darwin clearly himself believed in the heritability of behavior and not just of physiology. There's absolutely no question about that, and if you doubt it, I invite you to read the wonderful chapter on bees in The Origin of Species. He believed that behavior could be inherited, but he also believed that tiny differences in the predispositions to behave in certain ways could have remarkable differences upon the structure of social behavior in the mass. And the particular architecture of beehives was something that he explained in great detail could follow from very small adaptations in the particular instincts that led bees to construct wax, to lay down walls of wax in a particular way. And the discussion is wonderful both for its clear emphasis on the importance of heredity and the heritability of behavior, but also for its awareness that effects that come from the interaction of many individuals may not be ones that are themselves coded or hardwired in the particular instincts that make them possible. Secondly, Darwin clearly also believed very passionately in the major influence of environmental factors on social behavior. And nobody who reads his discussions of the human races in The Descent of Man can, I think, realistically doubt that. Now, as is well known, in the late 19th century and for much of the 20th century, all sorts of people's opinions lined up in favor of one or the other. The idea that heredity could influence behavior or that environmental factors could influence behavior were perceived as competing explanations. You either had to believe that fundamentally it was about heredity or that fundamentally it was about the environment, and that the more you believed in the one, the less you could decently believe in the other. I think, but this isn't going to be the subject of my talk, that we now have a way of seeing these influences as fundamentally complementary. Work in linguistics, for example, has made it clear that even if there is an astonishing variety of languages that are spoken across the world, they represent but a small subset of all the languages that could theoretically be spoken. There is, in other words, enormous amount of work for people to do to explain why languages differ from each other, just as there is an enormous amount of work to explain why languages are similar to each other. And it's also clear that without some idea of the hardwired factors that predispose us to learn in certain ways, we could not understand why languages have the structure they have. And I think that has become true now for a number of other areas of social life and not just linguistics. The fundamental principle, I think, that I'd like you to bear in mind in what follows is the wonderful phrase that concludes The Descent of Man: man still bears in his bodily frame the indelible stamp of his lowly origin. And for those of you tempted to read that as a rather gloomy statement about our animal nature and the way it pollutes our social behavior, I think it's only fair that you might go back and read the closing paragraph of The Origin of Species, where he talks about a noble view of life and talks about the evolution of one species from another as something that is uplifting. And I like to believe that his phrase that closes The Descent of Man was equally for him an uplifting sentiment. So let me now ask what we actually learn from our kinship with primates. And I think there are a lot of things which we learn that are not just characteristics of any social animal. We are, as Darwin was very much aware, group living primates for whom major determinants of fitness include our ability to cooperate with others in our group and the social intelligence to work out who can be trusted to cooperate with us and how we have to work upon the other members of our group to ensure that the benefits of cooperation come about. Now, within primate groups, there is indeed competition between individuals and frequently over very basic access to economic resources. But the key point about primate groups is that competition also goes on in two other dimensions. It goes on between groups and coalitions of individuals over access to resources, and it goes on between individuals over the right of access to powerful groups. And the tension between those forms of competition is absolutely at the heart of primate social life. At any one time, you are seeking to cooperate with a number of other members of your group, but at the same time, you're intensely anxious about which groups you may be allowed to join, because your fitness is going to depend not just on what you do, but on what you can induce the other members of your group to do with you and for you. And this means that in the psychology of being a primate, there is a continual tension between our talents for cooperation, which are many, and as I shall describe in human beings, are very sophisticated, and our talents and our predispositions towards competition. And this sometimes takes a very violent form. I'm going to talk in a moment about the evidence for violence in our past. And it's almost always stressful. And the reason it's stressful is that very small status differences can have very large fitness consequences. And anybody wondering about whether primates were responsible for the recent financial meltdown of the world economy cannot have been struck by the way in which very, very small apparent differences in talent have led to very, very large differences in remuneration. So that our economic structures faithfully reflect our primate past. Let me say a word about stress. It's well known that in dominance hierarchies in primate societies, there is an association between low status and a number of characteristics that are usually good predictors of stress. So things like the lack of social control, the unpredictability of the outcomes you face. These are things which are both very negatively associated with status rankings and also tend on their own to be key predictors of a stressful life. And interestingly, studies on human societies seem to suggest something very similar. There is a well-known longitudinal study of British civil servants by Michael Marmot and a number of collaborators, which, contrary to the popular view of stress-related illness, such as cardiac disease being associated with high-status jobs, has shown a very strong and reliable negative correlation with rank. So essentially, the lower down the hierarchy you are, the more likely you are to have somebody pushing you around, telling you what to do with your life. This is a very stressful thing to happen to you and is associated over time with very significantly greater risk of a number of stress-related illnesses such as cardiac disease. Now, it was widely believed, I think, until quite recently, that in primate groups exactly this, non-human primate groups, exactly the same thing was true. But when it was first possible to measure cortisol levels of primate groups in the wild, some slightly surprising results emerged. So an interesting paper by Muller and Wrangham, in which they actually followed chimpanzee groups around in the wild and somehow managed to get them to salivate over bunches of cotton wool. I can't imagine how they got them to do that, but they actually revealed a very surprising result that cortisol levels were positively correlated with dominance. And the authors suggest that this is actually because chimpanzees in the wild spend an awful lot of energy and an awful lot of resources in maintaining their dominance. In other words, it's a very tough and uncertain life up at the top there in a chimpanzee group. And your cortisol levels get elevated because of the continual uncertainty about how long you're going to stay on top. And any of you who don't know the wonderful book Chimpanzee Politics by Frantz De Waal, I strongly recommend it for an indication of how stressful it is to be at the top of a chimpanzee group. But you see from this that primate existence is pretty stressful either way. You get stress if you win, and you get stress if you lose. And the explanation seems to be precisely that very small differences in what you do make very big differences in the outcomes for you. And it's not surprising, in other words, that even though we're surrounded by our potential collaborators, we live in continual fear that our potential collaborators will not wish to collaborate with us, but will prefer to collaborate with somebody else. Okay, so that's roughly what we share with other primates, but what makes us different? And the answer is an awful lot of things. There is the obvious stuff, and it may seem ridiculous to you that I'm not going to talk about that further today, but many other people have talked about it, and I'm going to try and explore slightly less well-known terrain. So there's language, and there's elaborate uses of culture. But those, in some sense, come from many of the other things I'm going to tell you about, which have to do with the particular brains and bodies and social organization that we have that distinguishes us from other primates. So the first important thing is that we are very environmentally flexible. Compared to other primates, we live in a much wider range of environments, and we have very high returns to learning. Now, in case you thought that in this august institution of higher learning, we are one of the only places in the world in which you may have higher productivity at a late period in your life, I have news for you. Work by Hilly Kaplan and a number of collaborators has shown that even in hunter-gatherer groups, the returns to experience and human capital continue to be very high until people are in their mid-40s. These are pictures for the returns to male human capital, but the way you should read this graph is the following. What Kaplan and his collaborators have done, and they went around weighing the food that people brought home, they looked at the daily calorie production of men in three hunter-gatherer groups, and they compared that to the age of the men concerned. And what you see is that the productivity of male hunters peaks after around 35, in this group in the early 40s. And this is although it's well known that upper body strength for males is stronger in the early 20s than it will ever be again. And what this is suggesting is that hunting is an activity in which the returns are not so much to physical strength, but to cunning, experience, knowledge. This tells us also something about how important it was for human beings to have a reasonably long lifespan, because there is no point in investing in the ability to hunt in sophisticated ways if you're not going to be around long enough to reap the returns to that investment. Now, among the pressures that led to the evolution of humans with large enough brains to be able to learn, the rewards to hunting was obviously one of the leading factors that created that kind of adaptive pressure. But that adaptive pressure came with a cost. And in particular, if you're going to have very large brains, you either have to develop them in the womb during gestation, or you have to develop them after birth. And in humans, as is well known, when we stood upright, there was a natural limit to the breadth of the female pelvis, which ensured essentially that human babies had to be born systematically premature. Hence, they had to be dependent on their parents for a very long period after birth. And it was only because the returns to being large-brained later in life were larger enough that it was possible to incur the very high costs of being so dependent early in life. And what you see here, also from work by Kaplan and collaborators, is the remarkable contrast between the profile of the energy costs and benefits of being a chimpanzee over life and the profile of the equivalent for human beings. So let me talk you through what the graph says. Here, in this little graph over there, you have the net production in kilocalories per day of a chimpanzee over the course of its lifetime. And basically, this little bump tells you that until it's about 5, the chimpanzee is dependent on adults. But after that, it becomes reasonably self-sufficient until the point it's caring for young, but it's not producing a very large surplus. Humans, and these are data taken once again from hunter-gatherer groups, regularly and scrupulously followed around by Kaplan and a large number of collaborators. I've asked him whether he thought that this cramped their hunting style, and he assures me that it didn't. What you will see is that remarkably, in these hunter-gatherer groups, young individuals are dependent, they have a net calorie deficit my pointer seems to have a net battery deficit. you can see this little graph going up like that, and they're dependent until nearly the age of 20. These data are averages for several groups, and the story is not the same in every group. But essentially, young humans are dependent for a very long time. Now, I was surprised by these data because I thought, seeing my adolescent sons grow up and becoming rather strong and thinking that strength mattered, I assumed that by age of 12 or 13, a young hunter-gatherer male would probably be paying for his keep. But it turns out not, because the young hunter-gatherer male is eating an awful lot, and that also... that has echoes in my own experience. So it's really not until age 20 that the hunter-gatherer male is paying back. And then you see, he has to pay back a lot, and he has to pay back for a long time. And so that's a clue to how the cooperation across generations in hunter-gatherer groups has to be dramatically more sophisticated than it is in chimpanzees. Now, what you also see, therefore, is that if you look at the cumulative survival of chimpanzees and humans over time, you see this little rather sad graph here. It shows you the proportion of the chimpanzee band that is still alive after a certain age, and it drops very fast. Very, very high mortality among the young, but the curve is steep everywhere. Humans, there's a very steep part of the curve at the beginning because of infant and child mortality, but then it takes a much more serene downward slope. So the greater lifespan is part and parcel of the greater productivity of the adult males in humans. And that makes us quite different from all other primate groups. It means that we are collaborating across generations in a way essentially previously unknown in nature. And the result of this has been to raise very dramatically the returns to both pair bonding and, importantly, three-generational resource interdependence. So again, this is the last Kaplan graph I shall steal. So he and I have a reciprocal arrangement as well. He's going to steal some of my stuff. This shows the net transfers between, in kilocalories a day, between different generations of hunter-gatherer groups. So, for example, here we have the transfers from fathers to children, which are very high in the mid-40s. Here we have the transfers, sorry, this one. We have transfers from the mother to children. And interestingly, here we have transfers from the end here. So I'm trying to flick this so that it flashes since it went, it doesn't show uninterruptedly. Have you got another one?
You can use this one.
Oh, thank you. Thanks very much. Yes, there we are. Okay, so now these two graphs, encouraging for many of us, I think, are the grandparental ones. They show that there's a reason to be around, okay? And as I say, that's pretty encouraging. These resource transfers are a very important part of the overall ecology of a hunter-gatherer group, and they're part of what made us distinctively human. Okay, so what does all that mean? That means that we've been used since well before agriculture and civilization to elaborate networks of cooperation. And in particular, those networks of cooperation involved long-term trust and deferred gratification. There's lots of interesting evidence on trade within chimpanzee groups. For example, male chimpanzees who've been successful in a hunt will use meat to trade for sex with female chimpanzees, but the males, essentially, when they've handed over the meat, want the sex now. And the human capacity for deferred gratification seems to be infeasible in chimpanzee bands, and we have become much better at essentially delaying gratification for more complex social purposes. We also interact outside close kin, and that's obviously true in modern sophisticated economies. Think of the people that you met today, and how many of those were your close relatives? Very probably, if you're a typical member of a modern society, the great majority of the people you met would have been people you were not related to. Quite a few of them would have been total strangers. And that's something that makes us really very unusual in the animal kingdom. And what's interesting is that even in hunter-gatherer groups, there are many more complex operations, hunting operations, for example, which don't just take place between close relatives. Now, this emphasis on cooperation is something that makes sense of a remarkable puzzle about which a fascinating book has been written by Christoph Böhm that I strongly recommend, called Hierarchy in the Forest. Lest any of you think that the story I've been telling you so far is one about, you know, primate genes determining us to live in a primate way, nothing could be further from the truth, because what Böhm points out is that our primate nature has manifested itself in social behavior that has proved highly responsive to variations in our environment. And in particular, the puzzle that he's interested in is that most primate species other than our own in nature are very hierarchical. Modern humans are pretty hierarchical, but almost all of the evidence that we've been able to gather from about the lifestyle of hunter-gatherer groups has suggested that they were remarkably egalitarian. Both the existing hunter-gatherer groups that we've been able to study that are still around today and indirect evidence from extinct hunter-gatherer groups seems to suggest a remarkable degree of egalitarianism in their social arrangements. And essentially, what Böhm explains is not that somehow or other we had an egalitarian instinct that we have now lost, as some of the more wilder fantasies of the partisans of the Enlightenment might have wished us to have, but rather that a very strong tendency to compete, a very strong sense of status that we share with all other primate species, meets in human beings a strong tendency for coalitions of the weak to form to counterbalance the overweening behavior of the strong. And of course, in modern societies, the strong have ways to fight back. But in many hunter-gatherer societies, the strong, the people who are a bit better at hunting, that are a bit more manipulative, that are a bit more able to marshal the resources of the group, nevertheless are aware that if they abuse any of the privileges that this gives them, the weak may unite against them. And Böhm's book is full of interesting examples, both from chimpanzee societies, which he has studied, and from human societies, of the way in which big men who get too big for their boots provoke reactions by coalitions of the weak. And, of course, that's true only so long as coalitions of the weak are able to marshal the resources that make them able to take on the strong. And one of the reasons, according to Böhm, why modern societies are not as egalitarian as hunter-gatherer societies is that modern societies have been able to build surpluses through essentially agriculture and storable production that made the strong able to hire the services of mercenaries, to put it bluntly, to ensure that the weak could not effectively fight back. But in hunter-gatherer societies, you can't do that. Hunter-gatherer strong men are too dependent upon the support and the collaboration of those that surround them immediately to be able to exert dominance through fear. Now, as I mentioned, Darwin himself was very aware that the cooperation we see in human societies, both today and in the past, has been based upon a very strong degree of competition between groups. And this competition has in the past been extraordinarily violent. Now, just to give you a sense of the magnitude of the changes that we've seen, we have reason to believe, this is a controversial area, and I'm skating over some of the controversies, but I believe it's true to say that in non-state societies, that is to say both existent societies that do not have a state, and in societies of the past, estimates of the proportion of deaths due to violence range between around 15% and 30% of all deaths. Now, you may be wondering, is that a big number? Is that a small number? The answer is it's a very, very big number indeed. And to give you a sense of the comparison, you may believe through watching news reports on the television that the world today is a very violent place. But the proportion of people in the world today that die from violence is actually tiny compared to the proportion that once died. Let me show you this graph, which gives you a range of different estimates of the proportion of deaths due to violence here in existing non-state societies, and here in historical societies based on archaeological remains. It's difficult to estimate the proportion of people who've died from violence because a lot of violence doesn't leave marks on skeletons. We also know that skeletons that are found that have clearly died from violence may not be representative samples of all the people who have died. So there's a whole area of controversy around here, and that's reflected partly in the high variance of estimates. But what you will see is that the variance is very high. The general level of estimates of the proportion of people who died in these societies from violence has been very high. I mean, we're talking about, well, let's say in the early teens to as high as 25 and 30% of people having died from warfare. The world today is right up there. It's so small you can hardly see it. Today, the rates of violent death are around 1.3% of all deaths. That includes war, urban violence, everything. It's less, remarkably, than the rate of suicide. As a random citizen of the world today, you're more likely to die at your own hand than at the hand of somebody else. And it's only a little over half of the rate of death from road accidents. So something rather remarkable has happened. The competition between groups in the primate societies from which we evolved, which are, by the way, extremely high in chimpanzees and in other primate societies, have fallen dramatically during the period since we adopted a state. And that explanation, I think, is clearly, therefore, cultural and not genetic. And I say this in order to really to underline the point that is central to this argument, that our being primates and our being very strongly and determinedly primates doesn't mean that we are insensitive to changes in our environment. On the contrary, primates are animals above all that respond to the incentives in their environment. In fact, if you read Richard Wrangham, for example, has written a great deal about primate violence, and one of the things that's remarkable is the way in which the violence exercised by, for example, chimpanzees is highly dependent upon the context, upon opportunity. Chimpanzees can be extremely peaceful with each other until an opportunity comes to be violent and get away with it. So chimpanzees respond to their environment and to the incentives implicit in their environment as much as other primates and certainly as much as human beings. Here, interestingly, is a set of evidence about the way in which homicide rates evolved in England over the Middle Ages, well, from the 13th century to the 20th century. And one of the things you will see is these are all based on essentially village-level records. And what you will see is a very steady downward trend in the homicide rates over that period of time. No single thing was doing it. What was happening was a gradual development of a set of institutions that simply made it less rewarding for potentially violent individuals to carry that violence out. The English evidence, by the way, is not untypical of the European evidence. These are equivalent series for a number of European countries. Italy really was more violent in the Middle Ages. It's not just Shakespeare. And I think that's why Shakespeare gravitated to Italy as a source of dramatic material. But you'll see that, in fact, England was a rather tame place by comparison, but you'll see that England, Italy, the Netherlands, Scandinavia, Germany, and Switzerland all saw a steady decline in rates of homicide over that period. Once again, no magic bullet, no single thing that did it, but what I think is best understood as a steady, gradual increase in the extent to which human institutions made violence something that it was not profitable for individuals to exercise. Now, I want to talk to you in the second part of the talk about sexual selection, because This really is the key to understanding Darwin's ideas about the descent of man. And this is for a number of reasons. First of all, it's the key to understanding divergent evolution, rapid divergent evolution, how two populations could come to diverge in their characteristics from each other very fast. And that has been very recently argued, persuasively in my view, to be utterly crucial for understanding why Darwin was so interested in both the theory of evolution and specifically the theory of sexual selection. Adrian Desmond and James Moore, who've just published Darwin's Sacred Cause, have argued there that Darwin was driven at least as much as by a sense of scientific obligation by his detestation of the institution of slavery, which he had seen at close hand during the voyage of the Beagle, and in particular by the wish to show the defenders of slavery, who argued that slaves, that the black races were a different species from the white races, by Darwin's detestation of that institution, but in particular his belief that if it could be argued that all of the human races were descended from a single human ancestor, the case for mistreating the members of what he called the savage races in line with the usage of his time would be much weaker. And in order to do that, he had to explain why the black races and the white races and the brown races looked so different when they were really so similar. And so sexual selection, in a way that I'll describe in a moment, came to be crucial to that explanation. The other thing that's important for people who associate the notion of Darwinism with some kind of perfectionism or functionalism in the explanation of human behavior is that sexual selection shows us more clearly than any other mechanism how it is that natural selection can produce extraordinarily inefficient and repellent forms of behavior. Darwin himself famously said what a book a devil's chaplain might write about the clumsy, wasteful, blundering, low, and horribly cruel work of nature. And for people who've seen how admiringly Darwin wrote about the beehive, for example, and about some of the organs of the animal body, it can sometimes be a surprise that Darwin himself was completely aware of the fact that natural selection could produce extraordinarily inefficient and repellent results. And sexual selection gives us a very clear view how. The third thing, I think, in Darwin's view of sexual selection is that it really brought home the tension between cooperation and competition in social life. Anybody who's ever been involved in sexual relations will be aware, cannot have avoided thinking of the paradox that sexual reproduction is, in some respects, the most cooperative activity that any human beings can undertake. And yet, the search to be accepted as a sexual partner is one of the fiercest and most unforgiving forms of competition on the planet. And that paradox is something that was at the heart of Darwin's vision of both sexual selection and of competition in human society as a whole. And I think also, touchingly for Darwin, it was a reminder that nothing important in life is accomplished entirely alone. So, let me quickly talk you through the elements of sexual selection, because this tells you, in a sense, how it delivers on all of those four promises. Briefly, females are defined as the producers of the larger gametes among the two sexes, and these are relatively scarce. So human females produce an egg a month, males produce 1,000 sperm a second. And that means that in the time since I've been speaking, the men in this hall have produced enough sperm to fertilize all the women of reproductive age in Greater London. Obviously, the constraints on their ability to do so are not purely logistical. It would be good to be the chief executive of DHL if that were true. The constraints are essentially the competition from rival males and the selectivity of females. And males essentially benefit more than females do from strategies which increase the quantity of their offspring, either by defeating rival males or by overcoming female selectiveness. And the way they overcome female selectiveness is by offering or signaling the presence of the scarce resources that females need. Now, it might seem that at least for that this second strategy, persuading females rather than beating up rival males, male and female interests would be aligned. But in fact, as the study of many species in nature makes clear, this is true only for the current mating, and the interests for subsequent matings may be very different. Now, it's worth noting that female selectiveness doesn't typically mean monogamy. There is widespread evidence from a number of species, I don't have time to go into this, that even in socially monogamous animals, there are, such as many birds, a number of the eggs are fertilized by a male other than the female's partner. It's been alleged that this is true in Homo sapiens, but as a character in the television program, Yes Minister, said, you might say that, I couldn't possibly comment. Now, what happens as a result of sexual selection? Well, the answer depends very crucially between species, but it depends on the balance between force and persuasion. Are the males fighting each other so that the winner has access to the females, or are they persuading the females? And although it's true that some kind of differences are very common across species, like a greater established tendency for males in most species to take risks, most of the results of sexual selection vary enormously from one species to another, and even from one habitat to another. And the reason for this, as game theorists would put it, is that the strategies of males and females in any one species are best responses to each other. The strategies are, as we would say, co-evolving in what may be an evolutionary arms race. And it's important to note that divergent evolution is really an absolutely leading characteristic of sexual selection. So we know, for example, that in many cases, natural selection has produced the same answer to the same problem, but at multiple occasions throughout the history of life on our planet. So birds and bats have both evolved wings. Arctic and Antarctic fishes have both evolved a way of stopping their blood from freezing in the cold waters by essentially synthesizing antifreeze proteins, but they do so with quite different proteins and with quite different genes that encode for them. Anteaters in Africa and South America have developed long snouts, but they're not at all related, and the common ancestor almost certainly didn't have such a snout. Garter snakes and clams have both evolved a very similar process for evolving resistance to toxins in their prey. So natural selection against a reasonably static environment is often hitting on the same solution several times. Sexual selection is about co-evolving with somebody else, a mate or a rival, and therefore trying to hit a moving target. And so we see again and again examples of divergent evolution between very closely related species. They have very similar habitats, very similar histories, but their solution to the sexual selection problem has been very different. Now, I mentioned that sexual selection also explains conflict. Well, it occurs even over when and how to mate. And the reason for this is that the selectivity of females, which I mentioned before, creates an adaptive advantage for strategies of male persistence. And that, of course, in turn favors the evolution of female selectivity even more, because the more persistent the males are, the more important it is to be selective. So it turns out that it's not just adolescent human males who can't understand why females aren't willing to have sex with anyone at any time. It's also true of elephant seals and of water striders and of tunnel web spiders and of scorpions and of bed bugs. Here are the elephant seals. I don't have time to give you the full soap opera, but let's say that elephant seal males are constantly forcing themselves on unwilling females. These insects, the water striders, actually, I'm not sure they are insects, but somebody in this room probably knows, have evolved hooks on their antennae whose sole purpose is to hold the females down when the females are trying to escape. These tunnel web spiders anesthetize their mates with a powerful toxin and mate while they're unconscious. These scorpions have evolved a kinder strategy. The toxin they use for hunting is too powerful. It kills the female, so they have thoughtfully evolved a slightly less powerful drug that merely sends her to sleep. And the bed bug, Cimex lactarius, punctures the female's abdomen with a dagger, which inserts the sperm directly into the body because the female is otherwise too good at escaping. Now, the point about this is you can believe in the way in which selection is evolving behavior, and you don't have to believe it's optimal for anybody. And that's crucial to understanding how Darwin saw evolution as applying to human societies. Now, as you know, and this is well understood, when males compete for access to females, not by beating up other males, but by persuading and seducing the females, we expect selection not for just physical strength, but for display, and for attraction to the display on the part of the females. And this can lead famously to runaway selection, as in the case of the peacock's tail. There's also a theory that it may have applied to the human brain. And this theory is, in fact, anticipated in Darwin, though it's been recently developed by Geoffrey Miller and remains highly controversial. Here is the peacock. Now, I can show you a number of species, and you'll immediately guess which are the males, because they are the ones with the most colorful plumage. I'm going to show you two bird species and a primate species, which has an interesting twist. This is the first bird species, the regent bowerbird. The male is gorgeously colored. Here is the more familiar mallard. You can tell the male from the green on the head. This primate species has the very interesting peculiarity that the individuals in the front who appear to be males are actually females. This has been established with an expensive research grant. Now, the example shows you that primates have done sexual selection a bit differently. And we don't really know enough about exactly how this has happened. But humans, like some other primates, seem to be displaying in both directions. And the reasons for that are interesting. And there's a nice example of a non-primate that does this. And I want to just talk you through what the explanation might be. Imagine that the males are not just competing to impress the females, but the males have been able to get something that the females want and could persuade the females to compete for access to the quality males and not just to the quantity. Now, when the only thing males are contributing to the mating is sperm, that's not going to work because sperm, as I've already described, is very abundant. Any female who wants to can, in theory, have some. But it's when males can provide something that is a scarce resource that the whole incentive changes. Either when the males are monogamous, somewhat, or when the males contribute something scarce like food, then it becomes important to the females to compete for that. And there's a very nice example of a dance fly. It's called the Rampomia longicauda. And what happens with this dance fly is that the males enter these sort of big leks, these swarms of females, bearing little arthropods that they've killed as gifts for the females. And the females feed on those gifts while they mate. And the result of this is that it's really important to capture a male who has the economic resources. So the females compete for the males, and they've evolved air sacs, which are deceptive signals of abdomens that look as though they're full of eggs, but are not. And if you want to see this, look at the svelte profile of the male dance fly. You see? No beer belly there. And now look at the female. And that little sac is much cheaper than silicone. It is inflated by air. And it really works. The males go wild. Okay, so let me say, what does this mean for gender relations in apes and humans, and then what did Darwin think? Now, it's important to note that apes, of course, have done things very differently from dance flies, but among the other great apes, the chimpanzees, the bonobos, the orangutans, and the gorilla, to a different extent among the species, females are able to gain some degree of independence and autonomy. They're still facing attempts to control them by the males, but particularly in bonobos and chimpanzees, the females follow, as the primatologist Craig Stanford has said, their own reproductive agenda. And there are some very interesting things to say, which some of which I'm going to have to skip from the talk now, about the way in which female autonomy in chimpanzees and bonobos gave way over time as human females became more dependent on males than chimpanzee and bonobo females are. In fact, I'm going to have to move forward a little bit because I don't have time to talk you through all of that history. But what I want to do is very briefly to describe, first of all, how the basic economics of primate existence affects gender relations, talk a little bit about how that affects competition, and then say how much of that would have surprised Darwin himself. Now, basically what happened in the early evolution of our hominid ancestors was that the contract, if you like, which was standard among the great apes that are most closely related to us, the chimpanzees and bonobos, which is that the females more or less look after the upbringing of their young. They have considerable autonomy, and although they're hassled by the males, they have very substantial and effective responses, was rewritten for human females because they needed both protection and protein for the brains of their growing young. So you saw those curves which showed just how dependent the young of hunter-gatherer groups are. And the result of this was some loss of autonomy by human females, but this was limited by the fact that if you're going to be a gatherer in a hunter-gatherer group, you can't gather very effectively if you're under constant surveillance. And this was something that changed when human beings settled down to farming, because farmers are able to confine their females much more effectively than hunter-gatherers are. And so one of the interesting things is that we might ask as a result of this is the extent to which, now that economies are no longer based on agriculture, it's possible for gender relations to escape the apparent continual willingness of males to try to confine their females and to be able to do so because of the dependence of females on the male supply of economic resources. That condition no longer holds in modern societies. Let me tell you one last piece of evidence about primates. This concerns the fascinating, to my view, differences in the behavior of male and female chimpanzees with respect to the way they form coalitions. It turns out that conflicts between female chimpanzees are much rarer than between male chimpanzees, but they're much more often reconciled. So Franz de Waal, whose book Chimpanzee Politics I mentioned a few moments ago, studied chimpanzees in Arnhem Zoo by looking to see what happened when two individuals would meet. How often would they fight? And then once they'd fought, what was the probability of their reconciliation? And what he found was that reconciliation occurred after around half of the conflicts between adult males, but after less than one in five of the conflicts between the females. And males, when they intervene in favor or to try and break up a conflict between others, are much more likely to do so for strategic motives rather than in support of a friend. And as he puts it, I think rather poetically, he says males are much more willing than females to reconcile with their enemies and much more willing to betray their friends. Now, the result of this is quite striking, that male coalitions are strategic and they're status-oriented, they're flexible. When males have been fighting, they can hear that there's some food around, and then they stop fighting and they go off and look for the food. The female coalitions are much more loyal and stable and supportive and so on, but they're much less likely to go off on spec to look for food, and if they've been fighting, they're not going to make up just because there's a supply of food nearby. And This is not just true of chimpanzees. There have been similar findings in rhesus monkeys, for example. And one thing you can conclude from this is that, as sociologists sometimes put it, the males seem to have more weak ties and fewer strong ties in their networks. And that's a point I'll return to in 2 or 3 minutes. So, what did Darwin himself make of all of this? Well, there was some pretty strong stuff in The Descent of Man about females exercising choice, not a particularly popular topic in Victorian England. He said, in utterly barbarous tribes, I'm sure he enjoyed writing utterly barbarous, the women, he said, have more power in choosing, rejecting, and tempting their lovers, or of afterwards changing their husbands, than might have been expected. There's been a long discussion as to why The Descent of Man wasn't as influential immediately as The Origin of Species. In fact, it went into a long decline and was not really, didn't really emerge as part of, as a powerful influence on biologists until well into the 20th century. And it's possible that his rather revolutionary emphasis on the autonomy and the power of choice of females was partly involved. Now, he also said some things that look pretty odd to us. He said, the chief distinction in the intellectual power of the two sexes is shown by man attaining to a higher eminence in whatever he takes up than woman can attain. And then, a sentence which would certainly have denied him the presidency of Harvard had he been up for it, it is indeed fortunate that the law of the equal transmission of characters to both sexes has commonly prevailed through the whole class of mammals. Otherwise, it is probable that man would have become as superior in mental endowment to woman as the peacock is in ornamental plumage to the peahen. So I think we need to remember that Darwin, though astonishingly prescient, was in many ways a child of his time. And this is even more strongly marked when we look at what he wrote about race. I've said, and I believe this very powerfully, I've been very persuaded by the Book of Desmond and Moore, that the experience of slavery, which he saw at first hand on the Beagle, was an absolutely devastating experience and one that led him to wish to emphasize the common character of the human races. So in EMA, by the way, stands for the expression of the emotions in man and animals. He not only asserts repeatedly that the different races of men express their emotions with remarkable uniformity throughout the world, but then draws an important conclusion from this. He says, all the chief expressions exhibited by man are the same throughout the world. This fact is interesting as it affords a new argument in favor of the several races being descended from a single parent stock, which must have been almost completely human in structure and to a large extent in mind before the period at which the races diverged from each other. So this wasn't just a scientific hypothesis. This was a deep and powerful human engagement. But it did have its own rather curious 19th century twist. So here is a remark on the essence of savagery. He says, nor is it an anomalous fact that the children of savages should exhibit a stronger tendency to protrude their lips when sulky than the children of civilized Europeans. I could show him a few children of civilized Europeans. For the essence of savagery seems to consist in the retention of a primordial condition. Again, not politically correct language. And I think slightly more disturbingly, a weakness for eugenic arguments. Here are some pretty strong sentences. The weak members of civilized societies propagate their kind. No one who has attended to the breeding of domestic animals will doubt that this must be highly injurious to the race of man. Both sexes ought to refrain from marriage if in any marked degree inferior in body and mind. And then a sentence which, when I first read it, really caught me up. But I think having read now the book, the account by Desmond and Moore of what he saw on the Beagle, and in particular, the way in which the European settlers were systematically exterminating the inhabitants of Tierra del Fuego, I think this is written definitely in despondency and gloom and not in any sense of approbation. He says, at some future period, not very distant as measured by centuries, the civilized races of man will almost certainly exterminate and replace throughout the world the savage races. So Darwin was a great emphasizer of cooperation, but he was at the same time both, should we say, seduced by eugenic arguments whose consequences, it has to be said, did not become clear until well after he died. But we mustn't see him just as somebody who shares all of our own views in the garb of a decent 19th century gentleman, which he certainly was. There was also a charming element of parochialism. He says, Hottentots and Negroes have readily become excellent musicians, although they do not practice in their native countries anything that we should esteem as music. I like to think that if Darwin was wrong and there was an afterlife, that he would now be getting some lessons in music from the excellent Miriam Makeba, who would have joined him recently. Now, I just want to bring this to a close by saying a little bit about the biology of gender differences today. One thing which I think has been rather under-emphasized because of the degree of sensitivity of the biology of gender differences is that human males and females are much more similar in body and brain size and behavior than the history of sexual selection would have led a neutral observer to expect. Now, you know, that means that when we find it very difficult to see any differences in overall cognitive abilities between men and women, this isn't because we should never have thought of looking for them. This is a really interesting fact because it tells us that human males and human females were facing equally demanding cognitive challenges throughout all of our evolution, and that the subordinate condition and dependent condition of women that has been characterized of that has characterized relatively recent centuries cannot have been true of the great bulk of our evolution since our common ancestor with chimpanzees and bonobos. And I think that fact has been underemphasized because it suggests that because the history of gender differences has been so politicized and so sensitive, that we can't learn anything from the fact that these differences are so hard to find. I would also suggest that we are able to find more interesting differences in preferences for risks and so on, for the kind of competitive environment that people like to inhabit, and for how to form networks, which in no sense suggest differences in general cognitive talents, but may provide important clues as to why men and women still cluster very differently in their employment and their social life. And I want to close by giving you an example of this. This is based on work I'm currently conducting using data provided by Vodafone. And we've been interested, this is part of a wider project using telephone data from many countries, to look at the apparent differences in the kind of networks that men and women form. And what you have here is data from Italy and Greece about the average length of time that men and women spend on mobile phone calls. These are from actual billing data. And what you'll see is, these are just raw comparisons, but we've elsewhere done, and I won't show you the tables, attempts to try and control for income and various other characteristics. And what you see is that to an average of 16%, men and women make longer calls than men, but they make fewer calls, suggesting that something about the differences in their coalition behavior that we noted already from the studies in chimpanzees may be carrying through to the way men and women form networks, that in the language of sociology, again, many networks formed by women may be consist of more strong ties but fewer weak ties. And this isn't just that women are using the phone more because they're making fewer calls. These are the numbers of calls made as opposed to their length. And you see everywhere that the women who are in red are making smaller numbers of calls, but they're lasting longer. Now, there may be many explanations for this, and I won't talk you through all of the kinds of things that my co-authors and I are looking at. But it does suggest that preferences may differ between men and women, preferences for things like who you spend time with, how much time you spend with each person, how much you invest in the strong relationships, and how much you invest in the more casual relationships, could account for much more interesting developments in the way in which men and women cluster than we have so far been able to document. So finally, Darwin and competition. Well, I think Darwin saw with an astonishing clarity that escaped his contemporaries and those who took up his ideas with various political axes to grind, that yes, competition was everywhere, but but that it wasn't the antithesis of cooperation. The two were completely intimately intertwined. Now, all primate societies are like this. They all exemplify this. They embody competition between groups and networks and coalitions, and you struggle to be accepted by a group at the same time as you struggle to cooperate with other members of that group. And I think Darwin understood this. And as I suggested in that remark about the stamp of our lowly origin, I believe he celebrated our primate nature. And his own commitment to the unity of the human species was not a sort of pious afterthought. I think it was a seamless part of the whole picture. So I'd like to leave you with that haunting picture from St. Petersburg. And I'd like you to think as you look at that, that Eliot's vision of individuals lost in the mass, alienated and fearful, was missing something important. These individuals are passing through. Each of them leaves a tiny trace on the whole. But what they construct together is something greater than any individual can ever imagine. And that, I think, is a legacy that Darwin would have invited us to appreciate. Thank you.
Well, isn't economics a fascinating subject? Did you ever doubt it? But thank you, Paul, for making it so. And thank you for shifting our attention from the how and why of competition between to the how and why of cooperation of species. And thank you also for broadening our look to a much wider range of Darwin's writings, albeit a nicely critical view of them, showing how Darwin explains not just the origin of species, but the origin of the societies which they inhabit. And as you've shown so clearly and sensitively, in our own case, societies that are hugely complex, but also in many ways extremely fragile. Thank you very much.